are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum Radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and United Steelworkers District 11. United Auto Workers 249, members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world, and United Steelworkers District 11 representing 35,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, how do you rig an election? We'll investigate the playbook for voter suppression with activist William Waheed and Mac Heller, producer of a new documentary called Rigged, about the 2016 election. The interview with the Department of Labor about the bailout bill, the FFCRA, has actually been moved to next week. So that's the one that gives you family medical leave, expands that. In the news, University of Missouri graduate student teachers say they'll take a day off tomorrow to celebrate May Day. And Workers Center in Milan, Missouri, files suit against Smithfield, calling it a public nuisance. And now for the news. And now for the news from our side, April 30th, 2020. Wow, suddenly workers are getting a lot of attention in the media. After decades of being taken for granted, ignored, and trivialized, the conditions and essential nature of non-professional, blue-collar, and all kinds of service jobs are finally seeing a little bit of sun. Don't worry. As soon as this is over, the corporate media will go back to ignoring workers and quoting business leaders and politicians who fail to protect us and our families. We know this is a brief break in the storm that the working class has been experiencing since at least Reagan was president. So, there's way too much news right now to report about workers. Tonight, we'll just try to deliver some stories and angles you may not have heard on Democracy Now! Or from the corporate media. We'll start with this short piece announced today. Research Medical Center, Research Psychiatric Center, and Menorah Medical Center nurses will be marking Friday, May 1st, International Workers Day, also known as May Day, with shift change actions calling for optimal COVID-19 protections. This local action is part of nurses' actions taking place in 139 hospitals in 13 states representing more than 95,540 nurses, according to National Nurses United, NNU. Nurses say their demand for optimal PPE is underscored by the fact that more than 60 nurses across the country have died of COVID-19, although due to lack of testing, the number is surely higher. Nurses signed up to take care of their patients. They did not sign up to sacrifice their lives on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic, said NNU Executive Director Bonnie Castillo. She's an RN. On this day that celebrates the labor movement and working people, union nurses are standing up to demand the protections they need now.
Graduate students in the University of Missouri system announced today a May Day for graduate worker mental health. Of course, May Day, International Workers' Day, is tomorrow, and they are calling for a graduate teachers who are teaching online to take a day of rest. They said in a press release, as graduate workers within the University of Missouri system, we are under incredible strain due to the recent COVID-19 events and the subsequent actions and inactions of our state and administrations. As teachers, researchers, support staff, our labor is necessary for the effective running of our institutions. We are finding it increasingly difficult to perform our duties in a timely manner. Many of us live on stipends that put us below the poverty line. While the pandemic is beyond immediate control, the university system and the state of Missouri have done little to create stability in this trying time and have instead treated us as bargaining chips while ignoring our entreaties. Graduate teachers are sacrificing their own studies to support undergraduate students in their classrooms. Graduate teachers were given a single day in which to transfer their classes online and have not been given compensation or support for the increased workload. Previously approved graduate funding for next year, beginning fall 2020, has been put on hold. Our grad students are expected to work and work harder while the future of their respective institutions remains uncertain. We see the refusal to guarantee funding next year as a political move by administrations to threaten our faculty. It pits our faculties against our own. We will not be divided from our colleagues. Our international students are under immediate threat. They were not included in the CARE Act stimulus payment and are not eligible for the federal emergency financial aid provided there. Unable to return home and unable to legally work, these students face homelessness. This is not acceptable. The university system must guarantee summer funding for international graduate students now.
On Sunday, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the CDC issued guidelines for meatpacking plants. One might think that they do more than guidelines, which are voluntary and issue some emergency rules. This week, President Trump announced he's activating the Emergency Defense Procurement Law to force meatpacking plants, which have become petri dishes for COVID-19, to reopen or stay open. Workers who refuse to work unprotected by the voluntary guidelines could lose their unemployment. Does this move sound like a new form of slavery? Or is it just survival of the fittest policies for expendable humans? Anyway, some folks are trying to use the law in a different way. Last Friday in Milan, Missouri, the Rural Community Workers Alliance and an anonymous worker filed suit against Smithfield for creating a public nuisance because it failed to protect its workers. Actually, they filed on Thursday. The reasoning is that unprotected workers live in a community, have families, and when not working, live in those communities and families. Thus, they could communicate the virus. This is a nuisance, among other things. After the suit was filed, OSHA suddenly sprang into action and announced it will investigate to see if Smithfield could be found guilty of noncompliance with its voluntary guidelines. At the same time, Smithfield attorneys are asking a judge to dismiss the lawsuit, saying OSHA will take care of it. The RCWA lawsuit faults Smithfield for failing to provide personal protective equipment, social distancing, hand washing stations, and breaks to use those things, tissues, and a sick leave policy that doesn't penalize them for taking time off if they're sick. One disgusting detail in the brief that was that line workers who had no time to wipe their noses if they sneezed while the soon-to-be pork roasts passed under the very same noses. Last Friday, the judge refused to dismiss the case or delay it, and the hearing for an injunction was set for today. The RCWA and the worker are represented by lawyers for the Public Justice Food Project based in Washington, D.C., and Towards Justice based in Denver. At today's hearing before Judge Kays in the Federal District Court in Kansas, Smithfield asked for more time to submit another brief. They're calling. They got 24 hours, and the worker's lawyer got another 24 hours to respond. Stay tuned. And that's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Chris Mann, and I'm Judy Ansel.
And I was the youngest person to do so. I was determined to let Wallace see what he had done to me.
People spat on us. A lot of white clanners were there, a lot of white supremacists.
Oh, come on, put a gun.
This rebel flag on him.
And further ahead still, segregationists have been at work too, putting up posters on the roadside accusing Dr. Luther King of being communist trained. Another propaganda too, this time from the air. Light planes are dropping leaflets calling on white employers to sack their Negro workmen.
Turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on the freedom land. Ain't gonna let nobody, can't let them turn me around, Lord, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on a walk, you know, I keep on a mirrors, I'm marching on a freedom land. Ain't gonna let no jail house, ain't let it turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let no jail house turn me around, you know, I keep on a, I just keep on a mirrors, I'm marching on a freedom land. I can't let segregation turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let segregation turn me around. I just keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on the freedom land.
It was nothing but jubilation.
When we were at the Capitol and Wallace is up in the window peeping behind the blinds and he didn't come out to see my bandage over my head that covered the 7 stitches.
We had marched that 50 miles that they told us that we weren't going to march.
They had to surrender the steps of the Capitol. It's a very triumphant moment.
They told us we wouldn't get here. There were those who said that we would get here only over their dead bodies.
Well,
all the world today knows that we are here and we are standing before the forces of power in the state of Alabama saying we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
I was a doctor. Nothing did for us what that did.
Keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on the freedom land.
That song we've just listened to was Ain't Nobody Gonna Turn Me Around, sung and performed by the musical group Roots. This song was sung during the 1960s marches for voting rights in Selma to Montgomery. My name is Chris Mann, and I'll be hosting some wonderful guests tonight, and the subject of our conversation will be voter suppression. How strong is a democracy when segments of the country can't vote? And how strong is the democracy that allows this to happen? A powerful film has emerged on the pandemic horizon that calls us to our discussion tonight. The film is Rigged, a playbook for voter suppression. Our guest is co-executive producer Mac Heller. Hi, Mac.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
I don't have headphones. Okay, I just realized I needed headphones to be able to hear my guests correctly, so we're getting them. Okay, and in addition to Mac, we're welcoming William Waheed, retired community development specialist, author, and activist who lives in Selma, Alabama. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
Great. I'm glad to hear both of your voices. Before we get started, KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum are happy to co-sponsor the film, Rigged, Playbook for Voter Suppression, along with the filmmakers from the American Issues Initiative, a special showing of the film, and a Zoom panel discussion. And this will take place on May 21st at 7 o'clock p.m. So the free showing will be co-sponsored by all those groups and the Heartland Labor Forum and other Missouri organizations. I first watched the playbook for voter suppression in Brown Chapel in Selma, Alabama, the very same chapel where the marchers gathered to begin the walk to the Pettus Bridge, where they were beaten by Alabama state troopers and FBI agents. The film chronicles how the right to vote was deliberately compromised by people devising strategies for suppressing Black, Latino, and poverty-stricken voters within the last decade in the United States. The film is narrated by acclaimed actor Jeffrey Wright. So let's get right into the discussion, because we have a lot of things to talk about. Both Mac and William, can you tell our listeners about yourselves? What made you become interested in civil and human rights? Mac, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure, thanks. Chris, I've valued voting my whole life, and frankly, it always kind of...
Okay, it seems like we lost some connection with our guests. Okay, why don't we play our song?
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Well, on the backside, you know it's a
everybody. The music's
still.
Hi, everybody. Sorry about our technical difficulties.
Okay.
Mac, are you there?
I am. I hope William was talking while I was gone, or William, maybe you were gone too.
No. Well, we were listening to Sharon and the Daptones, This Land Is Your Land. So
right.
That's
what I was hearing.
Yes. Okay. So now, okay. Mac, you were telling us about what made you become interested in civil and human rights.
I valued voting my whole life and became concerned about 8 or 10 years ago at new laws being passed that deliberately made it more difficult or impossible for some of our fellow citizens to vote. And then when Shelby County versus Holder came down in 2013 and gutted the Voting Rights Act, which was a primary protection of that right, I became very concerned indeed and decided to get involved. And since Shelby County in 2013, about 20 states have passed these laws that make it difficult or impossible for many people to vote. And when I say many, our film tracks, North Carolina, where the number was 400,000, and Wisconsin, where the number was 300,000 people who were registered voters who were unable to vote pursuant to these new laws passed. And so we decided to make a film telling the story of the American citizens denied the right to vote by the voter suppression movement. And that's Rigged, the voter suppression playbook, the film, Chris, that we'll be showing with KFFI on May 21. And film documents voter suppression stories in North Carolina, Texas, Missouri, and Wisconsin. And in an unexpected development, we gained surprising access to the forces on the other side, the people who allege that our allege without evidence that our elections are riddled with fraud and that we need much tougher laws to stop this fraud. Well, we embed ourselves with, for instance, the North Carolina Voting Integrity Project, and we say, great, you know, let's go find the fraud boys, and we ride around with them in cars filming the whole time, and they don't find any fraud, but at the end of the film, they say, well, that just proves that it's even bigger than we thought, and that it's even bigger and more insidious than we thought, and you just got to shake your head in sadness when this happens.
Okay, and William, how did you get interested in all of this?
Well, just let me say, Chris, I got involved because the environment I grew up in produced me. I really didn't have any choice. It was either you succumb to the indignities as a human being, or you stand up and you fight to change a system that relegates you and others as being less than human. And so that environment produced me, and on through my days in the military, joining nonprofits in New York, and then exposed to a part of a cultural movement in New York, and moving to Mississippi, getting involved with activist movements there, and to Alabama when I became very interested in the movements in the 50s and how it has connected to what is happening today, and began to try and share some of those things so that we can keep...
Something's amiss with our equipment here. I want to read one more news story, but I just want to say about William and Mac that it takes everyone to realize what's happening with voter suppression in order to change this. No. And I would like to read one more news story while we're waiting for our connections with our guests. And this is about auto workers in Michigan. Another round of protests are set to converge on the state of Michigan Friday, though this time not to petition Governor Whitmer's stay-at-home order. According to the event's Facebook page, May Day Solidarity Caravan to Defend Workers' Lives, Detroit area auto workers and their supporters will caravan to Wyoming, Michigan to express solidarity with the United Auto Workers Local 167 shop chairman Travis Watkins. Watkins was fired by his employer, Caravan Management Facilities, LLC, for allegedly using his private Facebook page to alert members that management was escorting workers out of the plant on the suspicion they were COVID-19 infected, according to the event page. Watkins stands accused of creating panic in the workforce and defaming Caravan Management Facilities, LLC, and General Motors. Rank-and-file workers and unions across the country at Amazon, Instacart, Trader Joe's, and meatpacking facilities all through the Midwest have been calling on public attention to unsafe conditions at their workplaces, leading walkouts and demonstrations in various locations. Watkins has three charges pending with the National Labor Relations Board, one OSHA whistleblower filing, as well as grievances filed with his local union. Watkins just started receiving unemployment compensation after weeks without pay, since the reason he listed for unemployment was disciplinary. The General Motors part in Wyoming is currently shuttered due to the coronavirus. Workers affiliated with Reform Group's Auto Workers Caravan and Unite All Workers for Democracy and their supporters will meet at Local 167 in Wyoming and will form a mobile in-car protest at the facility where Watkins was fired, demanding his immediate reinstatement. For more information, please visit uawd.org. And there is a GoFundMe page and a petition at change.org. Okay. All right. We're back in a slightly different format. So can both of you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Now, as each of you were talking about yourselves and what made you become involved in civil and human rights, I realized that this fight is going to take all of the approaches, and both of you presented a more macro approach and a micro approach. So it's going to take all of us. So what is MAC, the American Issues Initiative? What was the impetus for undertaking this initiative, and what's going to be the outcome?
American Issues Initiative is a small organization that we created to make the film. And our purview is voting rights and fighting for voting rights and against voter suppression. And we're a small group, but we care a lot, and we work pretty hard, and our message is getting out. The film's been out for a little bit now, and we're distributing it. The film's available on Amazon Prime and Apple iTunes. And in addition, before the virus hit, we were going around doing screenings at colleges and universities and community groups and conferences, and we were honored to show the film at the Brown Chapel AME Church in Selma, which is just 2 months ago. We want to educate and motivate. You can't see this film and not get angry. If you care about our democracy, if you care about equality, if you value the voice of every one of your fellow citizens, at the end of this film, you're going to be angry.
So what part or parts of the film did each of you identify with? Which scene struck a chord with you?
Well, just let me just say, I guess all of it, but in particular, Mac, you know, I'm from North Carolina originally. That's my birthplace, and family, have extended family out of Cumberland County, and just North Carolina, and grew up in the county of the governor that erased black voters in North Carolina, in Wayne County, the birthplace of Charles B. Acock. So all of this was very personal to me, as well as just looking at someone actually mapping the systemic erosion of voting rights, what we've read about and what we've seen. But to just see someone map it in the way that you all did was very touching.
You know, Cumberland County, where you're from, is Fayetteville, and in the film we show a purging operation that cut 6,000 voters from the voting rolls in one town of about 100,000 voters. Okay. And the guys doing this are in the film pretty prominently and say memorable lines like, finding these people whom they feel are fraudulent voters, they just have a knack for it. It's like finding a lump of coal in a bale of cotton.
Yeah.
And you just have to, you know, it takes your breath away to hear that. And you can chuckle at these guys, but they're powerful. They took 6,000 names off the voting rolls. And we sat there in the Cumberland County Board of Elections. And by the way, we also had footage from Moore County and Beaufort County, same operation, some of the same guys. And the county Board of Elections just went ahead and cut them. And it was pursuant to the 1903 law passed by, among others, Charles Acock.
Right.
And when North Carolina passed that law, the newspapers of the time say that the necessity was to cleanse, their word, cleanse the voting rolls of the handful of African-American citizens who were still brave enough to have not been intimidated by all the violence that had been brought to them before 1903. And that 1903 law, still on the books, still being used to cut black people from the voting rolls. And this is a state where the state legislature gerrymandered in 2010, passed a law that limited voting rights in 8 or 10 different ways, and was struck down by the federal courts in North Carolina with the comment that the law targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. So the legislature, Chris, asked for data on which ways people of different races voted in North Carolina. And once they had the data on the ways that black people were more likely to vote than white people, that's what they cut.
Well, Mike, Chris, may I ask Mike a question?
Sure.
Mike, well, how do you, what's the rationale for the mayor of Charlotte, a Democratic mayor, campaigning and receiving the Republican National Convention in North Carolina?
I got nothing intelligent to say.
Okay. So,
I mean, I just asked because you were closer to it than I was, but I had the same thing, but I just wondered, maybe it's something that I missed.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, why would you reward that behavior with a multi-million-dollar convention?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And many of our listeners don't know that William wrote a book called The Courageous Eight about voting rights in Selma in the 60s. And so I want to ask him why, in your opinion, William, based on your research, was centering the right to vote the correct choice for the civil rights movement at that time in history, 1964?
It was certainly one of the top strategies, and probably and no doubt a necessary strategy, And Chris, in my book, I point out that this struggle to gain the right to vote was pushed heavily after World War II. But it began as early as in 1920, and the idea was that if black citizens could get access to the polls, that through the vote, they could vote in people and resources to be able to change a system and thereby improve the living conditions of the poor, especially poor black Americans. So key to that was gaining access to the polls. So that voting rights movement was totally necessary in order to carry out the strategies and the goals that they had started in 1920.
Okay. And I'm going to ask one more question, and then, believe it or not, we have to go to a break. The other breaks were unplanned. We have to station identify. But with this film rigged, and Carol Anderson wrote a new book, One Person, No Vote, there is the assertion that throughout history, every time African Americans have made advances toward full participation, white reaction begins to plot to undermine these advances. What do you think about that, Mac?
It's factually true. You know, in Mississippi after the Civil War, the majority of the citizens were African American. And what ensued once the federal troops left was a campaign of domestic terrorism to intimidate them from exercising the franchise. And so by the time you get to 1910, 1920, the percentage of black people voting in Mississippi was in the single digits. And then let's go to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was another step forward. And that law has been challenged in court and argued against and jawboned and finally limited in 2013. And you know, this is a law that was part of our bedrock gospel in this country for decades. In the last time it was renewed, even Strom Thurmond voted for this bill. And now a Voting Rights Renewal Act has been proposed in Congress, passed in the House, and is sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk, and a bill that Strom Thurmond supported cannot even find a vote in the U.S. Senate today. So is that backlash? Yeah, that's backlash. You know, we have some footage, we didn't use it in the film, of a number of groups after the election of President Obama. This footage is 2009 and 2010. With people looking out in the crowd saying, something changed in my country, you know, recently, and I'm not sure what it is, but I feel my country is no longer my own. And you look out right to a sea of white people, and it's just wrong. That's not America. That's not America. But backlash is real, and we need to face it, we need to talk about it, we need to deal with it, and we need to stop it.
And William, do you have a quick comment before we go to break?
Let me also add to that is that one of the things that's not seen as well in that backlash is that there is a shadow or a track record that when the black citizens push for civil and voting rights, it also brings about other progressive forces to the table. So if you stop black voting rights, you stop voting rights for women. You stop voting rights for Latinos, because the energy in each one of these movements that black citizens have engineered, you have found other groups have found their voice as well against this neoconservative political domination. So it is a backlash. There's no question about it. But in addition to that backlash, and I use Dr. King as an example, look at the people that united around the anti-war movement in which he was able to articulate that movement. So it's that kind of, if you get black folks out here pushing for things who have all the reason in the world who want to make system change, it also serves as a magnet to bring other people to the table.
Okay, we are going to go for a short break to play promotions, and we will be back in about 2 minutes.
Hey, this is Grant Conrad, and I want to talk to you a second about KKFI's Vehicle for Charity program. Do you go repair after repair on your vehicle? You fix one thing just to find another thing is broken? Well, you can actually do a tax-deductible donation of that vehicle to KKFI. All you need to do is call Bill at 816-994-7869. That's 816-994-7869.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Yes, FFI, I'm sorry.
Okay, go back.
Okay, we're back from our promotions, and we're going to try to zip through because we had some interruptions earlier. So I picked out a couple of film reviews of the film Rigged, and one gentleman said there was no impartiality in the film. It only presented one side of the story and cast the other side in unfavorable light. And then another review said the film is well done with great commentary on both sides. Thanks to the producers for the time and effort. So, Mac, did you make this film to be one-sided? And William, did you find the film to be one-sided?
Well, we certainly didn't make it to be one-sided. I am not a lover of either party. I'm an independent American citizen, and we were journalists looking for the truth. And I don't think anybody anywhere can deny any American the right to vote. Both parties have engaged in gerrymandering over the last 10 years. And by the way, we took these allegations of voter fraud very seriously, and we chased them down. And when people made allegations, like Kris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas, we went and met with him and said, so tell us about these allegations. And if fraud's being committed, I want to know about it and I want to stop it. And so I can't tell you how much time I've spent over the last 3 or 4 years chasing down inflated allegations of massive voter fraud, only to find that it's a little bit smaller. Well, I'm not sure it happened, but I heard it happened. Well, maybe it didn't happen, but it could happen. And before you know it, there's nothing there. I could tell you that same story, and we show it in the film a number of times, that there's just nothing there. So we pursued both sides of this very faithfully. But in case we didn't, we give the forces of the other side the microphone. We let them tell their story. And we've got plenty of people from the voter integrity movement and plenty of people from the Republican Party giving their perspective, and then obviously letting the viewer decide on his or her own. Having said that, the state legislatures that are passing these laws are almost uniformly controlled by one party. And where they're not controlled by one party, or where they're controlled by the other party, these laws don't happen. So I'm not going to close my eyes to that. I'm going to report the truth. It's in the film. Go take a look. By the way, I haven't seen the film on the other side, the film documenting voter fraud. The president created a commission of 8 or 10 august human beings to go look for voter fraud and once and forever put this debate to rest. and they made a bunch of noise for a few months, and then the amount of voter fraud as to which they made formal findings, which is what commissions do, was zero, and then the president put his tail between his legs and disbanded the commission. Anyone who can't see what's going on here is blind. So, William, I'll shut up.
Well, just let me just say that I think you all did an excellent job, because all the parties that were involved actually spoke for themselves. They gave their own points of view. So it was not like you just talked to citizens whose votes were suppressed. You were talking to people who did the suppression and why they did the suppression. I think if you were really out to get people like that, maybe the reviewer said, you could have easily gone back in to look at what happened in Ohio in 2004, where there is volumes of evidence of voter suppression by the Secretary of State and by county officials all throughout that the Republican Party did. So I think what you did, you allowed the ingenuity that you were able to put this piece together. You let people speak for themselves.
Yes, I would have to agree with that. It's a beautiful film in that you do allow the people to speak in the film, and there's an especially humorous part in there where one person said he saw busloads and busloads of people coming in for voter fraud, and when pressed, he said he heard it. So
he said maybe I saw buses on TV.
Right.
Now, somehow, having seen buses on TV, and someone must have told him that those buses were in New Hampshire, somehow he knew that they were full of people who were not New Hampshire voters who went and voted in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
To me, that's really hard to tell from a TV camera, but he was able to do it.
Yes, yes. Okay, and one other film review said that they wished we included problems with the voting machines. Did you encounter, do you think people trust the voting machines, being that there's all this other suppression around?
I think we've got two issues with the election coming up in November of this year. One is with voting technology, including voting machines, and the other is obviously with the virus. And I think they both should be treated as nonpartisan, objective problems. We want the voting machines to be secure. We want the voting process to be secure. And on the virus, we want to be able to exercise our democracy without fear of contamination and death. And we look to our state governments to engineer safe methods, safe, secure methods for us to do that. And I would like to imagine that to be a nonpartisan process. But somehow this becomes partisan. We all watched what happened in Wisconsin a couple weeks ago, where in the middle of this virus, the Democratic governor said, as many other governors had said before him, including the Republican governor of Ohio, well, this is not safe. Let's just postpone the primary, a few weeks and until the virus has retreated a little bit. Everybody decided to do that, including the Democratic governor of Wisconsin. But the Republican legislature, seeing an advantage in holding the election during the virus, reversed him and required that the election be held. And it was held. And on whom did the burden of this fall? Well, the thing about Wisconsin is that about 70 or 80% of the African American voters live in one county, and that's right. Milwaukee County. And right. If you can suppress the vote in Milwaukee County, you will suppress the African American vote in Wisconsin.
Right.
And so whereas Milwaukee County usually has 180 polling places, because they were holding the election during the virus, they couldn't get poll workers, and so 180 places became five. So there's massive confusion about how do I vote, where can I vote, where do I go? I don't own a car. Are the buses operating? Is it safe for me to get on the bus? Is it safe for me to wait in line? And so, you know, the fact that this keeps happening and somehow it always falls on the shoulders of people who are black, brown, and poor. Somehow you got to say there's a pattern here and maybe somebody's intending this. So this voting technology, voting machine issue has to be taken out of the partisan context. So does the voting safety issue be taken out of the partisan context. And right-thinking governors and right-thinking secretaries of state have to spend some money and solve this. We've been asking the federal government to do it for about 6 or 8 months, and they're not going to. And it's silly to think they will, because Mitch McConnell's had these cybersecurity bills on his desk for most of a year. He passed one. It's smaller. It's too little, too late. A solution's got to be down at the states, and people need to get on it now, because who knows where this virus is going to be. With respect to security of machines, there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of technology, a lot of experience, and people at the Secretary of State level are generally applying it faithfully. I can't say that of all states. Georgia, for reasons I don't understand, has been very slow in having paper ballots, which provide a record and allow you as a voter to make sure your vote counted. But there's a lot of shenanigans that can happen here, and voters need to keep their eye on both of these issues, and they need to do it now.
Well, okay. You know, the virus certainly is a factor, but let's not forget that the same thing that we saw even in Wisconsin happened in Ohio in 2004, and there was no virus.
Correct.
You had the same type of voter suppression. You had the same kind of eliminating voting polls. You even had switching votes from Democrats to Republicans. You had all of that, and the computer companies that handle the balloting and the voting machines, all by majority Republican supported organizations. So we've got a mess, and that leads me to say, Chris and Mac, and like you, I'm an independent, and I was extremely disturbed as to where we are now, realizing that George Bush stole two elections, not one but two. And in 2008, the Democrats had control for at least 2 years and a Democrat president, and they took no substantial action to secure the voting safety of citizens after 2 years of stealing elections, and they didn't put anybody in jail for fraud. So it gave the signal that it's okay. And then you come back in 2010, these state houses take over, and now we got this monster that we got now. We're trying to take a rat out of the snake's mouth. It's going to be hard to do. So
okay.
I don't know how we do it. I think we can still be persistent. I think if we can overcome the odds in 6-4 and 6-5, we certainly can do it in 2020. But it's going to take that type of vigilance, that type of effort. And along with that, my point is, at the local levels, we don't have any comprehensive plans or strategic plans. We don't have anything that we're voting for except biology.
Okay.
The biology is a female,
William.
It's a woman, or it's a Democrat.
Okay. Well, okay, William, I got a break in here. Our time is up. Thanks to our guest, Mac Heller, producer of the film Rigged, Playbook for Voter Suppression, and William Waheed, author of The Courageous Eight. I want to conclude by saying that when you deprive people of the right to vote, the vote being the very fiber of this wonderful quilt we call a democracy. And when you begin to tear the threads away, saying this person can't vote or that person can't vote, the next thing you know, you will not have a democracy.
Okay, it's time for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. There's a bunch of International May Day, International Workers' Day, May Day celebrations tomorrow. You can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page, which we recommend that you like and get notifications from. There are international Zoom conferences. There's a conference with Cooperation Jackson. And one of the speakers is Michael Yates, who wrote Why Unions Matter. There's a virtual May Day System in Crisis from Labor Notes. All of these are taking place tomorrow, along with one from the Communications Workers, which is going to have Reverend William Barber and Senator Elizabeth Warren on it. You can find all of this on our Facebook page, our Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Thanks for tuning in to the show tonight. Tune in tomorrow. Tune in next week, next Thursday. Our show is going to be called May Day from Quarantine and Expanded Family Leave. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
But I was too young to see. Now after 15 years. There is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people. Sweating for an earnest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride. We've still got our pride. 'Cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.